Hello, everybody, and once again, welcome to the Zelda Universe Podcast. We thank you for joining us as we revisit the many aspects of our adventures in Hyrule. My name is Connor Schultz. It is wonderful to see you all again, or I guess talk to you all again. Joining with me today, we have two of our wonderful staff members here of Zelda Universe. We'll start with Claire.
Hi, everyone. My name is Claire, and I'm a columnist and an assistant news editor for Zelda Universe.
And Maisie. Do I have that right, or Maisie?
Maisie's right. Yeah, Maisie's right.
Maisie's right. Good.
Yeah. Hiya, I'm Maisie. I'm a list writer, and I'm currently living in Cardiff, Wales.
And thank you for joining us at what is now a very late hour for you, somewhat early for me. We have a pretty broad time gap between each other.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
So, our subject matter of today, as we come through with the Zelda Universe podcast, we've changed things up a couple of times as we've gone through a few iterations of the podcast, but we are here to highlight the topics and articles written by our many wonderful writers here at Zelda Universe, Claire and being two of them. And as you kind of saw before, I will apologize right now for any mispronunciations for any names that we may be using in this, especially as we get into people that we have never heard a pronunciation for ever. We will do our very best. Our introductory music this episode was brought to us through Majora's Mask, and specifically the theme for Cremia's Carriage. We only hear this song once through the entirety of Majora's Mask. Well, I guess once is not technically correct. You can play it as many times as you want. It just kind of depends on how frequently you want to set the clock back. I found this one to be deceptively calm. It's funny to listen to this piece of music without anything else that's normally accompanying what is going on with this song. It's all nice, pleasant, cheerful. Yeah. We're going on a wagon ride. And then we...
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very calming piece of music. And like you said, it's very unassuming. Unlike her, it's all very well held together. Her life is just sort of falling apart, really, is in the game, isn't it? You know, the person she loves is getting married and she's not doing well with the farm.
She does a pretty good job of holding everything together as best she can.
Mm.
And it's funny how she uses this opportunity to tell all of her woes to a complete stranger who is, as far as we can tell, the exact same age as her younger sister, who she is trying desperately to protect from everything that is going on.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that she trusts Link so much, given that Link and the sister are the same age. But she talks to Link like more, how do I word it? Like more mature. Like she sees him more in that light compared to her sister.
It is fitting that you use that terminology, though, considering what we get for defending the milk cart at the end.
Yeah, I remember when I saw that for the first time, I was like, what's going on with this cutscene? It was very unassuming, but I thought it was very wholesome for both Link and Cremia.
This is a bit of an aside. The article that we have on the website has an image that is pretty well popularized. And that's Cremia actually giving Link a hug. I have never seen that in game. I don't know what you need to do
really?
To trigger it. I don't know if you need to have like perfect, if it has to be after you get the Romani's mask.
I think it happens after you get the mask, and it's a random chance of it happening, but please don't come at me.
Oh, Yeah, I don't think I came across that either. I played Majora's Mask years ago, and I really struggled with the time loops. I don't know why. But yeah, that's not something I came across. So when I was looking it up, I thought, I haven't seen that. So yeah, it's interesting.
I've seen it so many times, and yet I've never been able to trigger it. I play these games on a regular basis, and so it's not like it's been forever. And no, I've never done it. I think initially I thought I had either forgotten something or if someone had like modded it in or something. I'm going to have to probably look up how that is supposed to be done.
It seems like out of place in a good way, given all the chaos going on in Majora's Mask. And then you have this wholesome cutscene, you know, Link's traumatized, going through all these time loops. And then we have this scene with him getting a hug. I could go on and on about that, but I really appreciate it.
I personally think that a lot more of these characters could use hugs.
Yeah, especially, yeah.
For sure.
I play enough of more character-focused games and to know that these characters need more hugs in their lives. Like, why? You all need this. You need some love. You need something. Everyone in Majora's Mask, honestly, could use a little bit more hugging in their lives.
Yeah, especially Link.
Let me love you.
At least we get a wedding, though. That's fun. That's some love. And they hug. Anju and Kafe get to hug. This is important.
That is true.
This is important stuff.
I think when she gives him a hug, it can either be he gets like a heartwarming hug, or he receives a gold rupee. I saw. That's another alternative as well. So I don't know. Is that the one you got?
Really? Apparently. I think probably my problem is the fact that I usually do it once and then I never do it again.
Fair. Yeah, I'm the same.
Because there's so many time loops to do. And the only time where I could potentially be doing something like that is usually if I'm doing a final run before finishing the game. I will, at the very least, do the cafe quest. But I like to try and do like the big things all in one go to kind of set the timeline right, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah.
It's just kind of become a tradition for me. At the very least, Kafe and Anju has to be done twice. One to get the couple's mask, and one to actually do it. Because it's like, no, I must save you!
Yeah, I think that's why I struggled with Majora's Mask. I think I was only like 15 when I played it. So I just wanted to make sure everything was okay for the characters. But it just made me really confused by the end. So I just sort of stumbled through it thinking, I think I got everything, right? Is that how everything worked out? So I know what you mean. I wanted to get everything done. But also there seemed to be alternative endings to things. I didn't quite understand it at the time. So I need to go back and play it because I think I'm going to understand it a lot more this time.
I hope you are successful in doing that. Well, thank you to Kayla Dandurand, our resident songstress and song historian. This is the second time in a row we've had her articles. It might be possible that Kayla is our primary melodies contributor. And so very much thank you to Kayla. We will now take a journey through the realm of memories, where we reflect on some personal journeys through Hyrule and the many ways that the Zelda series has touched our lives. This month's memory comes to us from Briar Washabaugh. Again, apologies for any horrible mispronunciations that I happen to throw out there. Who discovered exactly what it meant to explore Hyrule to the fullest. The title that Briar gives to the column is Melania's Method, and I was completely misled by the title and by the opening image, because I thought we were going to be talking about horses.
Same.
I thought maybe, yeah. We were going to talk about meeting Melania, who is certainly a unique character, especially as far as fairies go. Maybe a horse had died. Maybe he actually got eaten. But no, it's the core, honestly, of what Breath of the Wild was essentially designed to be, which is open world exploration. How familiar are the two of you with, at least before Breath of the Wild, how familiar were you with the open world concept?
Not at all. Breath of the Wild was the first game I played that was open world. I bought Skyrim for the Switch immediately after, as soon as it came out after Breath of the Wild, but that's because I was so inspired through playing Breath of the Wild. I went for like a grittier open world game after that. But yeah, Breath of the Wild was the first one I encountered.
I think it's the same for me. It's my first open world game too. I think it's just because I've been overwhelmed, or open world games kind of overwhelm me. Like, I never really know what to do, so I never really were attracted to those kinds of games.
I've had that problem. The one time I tried Skyrim, actually, was, what am I doing here? That opening segment was great, but wait, what am I doing? Where am I going? Why do I care? I just don't want to be eaten by a dragon. I think I can do that. I have been with the Zelda franchise from the beginning, and so the open world concept, which was the core of the original Zelda, I have been at least acquainted with. But you talk about intimidation, a 5-year-old trying to wander around just the original Zelda map was challenging. I was perpetually lost. Thankfully, we have more modern quality of life improvements, like actually having a map to tell us where things are. But the original Zelda, A Link to the Past, that open world concept, at least in terms of having an expansive environment, has always been at the very least at the origins of Zelda. It fascinates me, honestly, that Breyer here was, he says that they were so set on the usual more linear format of Zelda that's how they played it initially, linearly.
Yeah, I guess that's the same for me with the open world Zelda games. I mean, I never finished Breath of the Wild, but you definitely have to see it in a different way, like not in a linear way. I don't know how to explain it.
It's very overwhelming at first. You don't know what to do. Obviously, you're directed to the old man, who obviously turns out to be, you know, Zelda's dad, but you walk out and you see the whole land, and you don't know what to do first. And I think that's the intimidating thing. And because it's so expansive, there's so much more to do, like get all the Korok seeds. I've not done that. I couldn't possibly find them all without, you know, going on YouTube and figure out where they all are. I think that's a great thing about open world games, but also I think that may be the bit about open world games that I find very frustrating. I don't know how I can completely finish it. Linear games, I think it's quite easy to have that sense of achievement that you're unlocking the next suit, the next armor to get to that next level. I think there is that sort of direct correlation to achievement there, but open world games are so much more, I suppose, relative to where you are in the game. It's a strange experience, but I just found Breath of the Wild really refreshing just because of how it looked. It was a really nice form of escapism for me. But yeah, it's a beautiful game, but it's very overwhelming at the same time, I think.
The challenge that open world and that kind of open format for a game is figuring out what it is that you yourself want to do when given limitless possibilities. With Breath of the Wild, it's primarily a matter of direction. Where do you want to go? And so when you're trying to decide to do that, giving the player multiple options is probably the best way to do that, because you can, at the very least, begin Breath of the Wild linearly. You have to do the entirety of the Great Plateau first before you're allowed to go anywhere. So that gives you a good idea of how to do everything. The king gives you a suggestion on where to go first. And I know I went that direction first to Kakariko. And that kind of leads you then to Hateno, back to Kakariko. And you have a pretty general idea of, okay, this. Okay, now I can see, all right, I got to go to these four locations. But the fact that it gives you multiple destinations at once means that that linearity has already begun to split. So, all right, I have these four places. Where should I go? Well, this place is closest, so I'm going to go to the closest one. Well, how do you go to Zora's Domain? And that suddenly creates a question, because there's no one set road to Zora's Domain. And maybe the road you initially choose is a little too dangerous for you. And so you have to backtrack and think about it again. I started, honestly, before I went to any of them, I was super interested in all of the photos, because that was the last thing that I was given, was to get the memory photos. So I ended up getting the direction. I was like, oh yeah, I know where this is from Pinko. I'm probably butchering his name, the painter. Oh yeah, no, I remember that place. It's over that way, the Nehru's Gate. All right, so then you head that way. And instead of just saying, go do whatever, it's, here are some suggestions. All of these things can be beneficial for you. How do you want to get there? And that, I think, is just enough information to say, okay, I know what's going on. This is a big place, but I have some general ideas of what it is that I want to do. And it gives just enough direction to give you the open world freedom without overwhelming us with the, what's going on? What do I do? I don't know.
Yeah, it's very easy to get sidetracked in that game. Like, you'll be walking down the path. Oh, I'm going to this place. And then you see a Korok on the side of the road that needs help. And then next thing you know, you're going somewhere else in the completely opposite direction because someone else needs your help. And then a couple hours go by and it's like, oh, I didn't get to that destination.
Oh, the number of times I literally scaled up a mountain and tried to paraglide, didn't have enough stamina, I could have literally just taken the road to where I needed to go. I felt, you know, when I was doing it, I was like, oh, I'm so stupid. Why did I do that? But yeah, it was good fun. And again, that's just my linear way of thinking. Oh, I'll just go in a straight line right there. Why would I take a road that leads me there, but just winds, you know, curves a bit? I suppose that was me being, you know, quite new to an open world.
Every adventure is different. One of the Briar's description of something that they tried to do, and something that I would recommend to anyone playing or replaying Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom, is to, as much as you can, eliminate your usage of teleportation. Just go on foot or by horseback and see where the journey takes you. Because Breath of the Wild in particular is a very relaxing game. And you can do that even more by just going out and seeing what's available to you.
It's all about the journey, not the destination.
Anyone else sick of that phrase? I hear it so much. It's not wrong, but
it was really nice though, because it's, you know, it's about the journey, but it was really funny because I got the, oh, it's the champions, like the DLC I got, but and then you get the bike. So I went from going on horseback across Hyrule, it's all really chill, and then I got the bike, and then all that journey just got a little bit manic. I'm just trying to like rev up mountains in it. I thought, this is just, I am not teleporting, but also it's pretty frantic. I'm not being chill about this. Yeah,
it's probably good that that's the last thing you can possibly get. All right, you've explored all of this. You've gotten all this stuff. Here's a bike. Go have fun.
Yeah, the game was over when I got that bike. Yeah, it was good.
Well, thank you, Briar, for helping us take this trip through the realm of memories. And we now open the pages of our Bomber's Notebook, the series where we take a special look at the various and unique characters found in the Legend of Zelda series. This entry in the notebook was composed by Caitlin Druitt. And we turn to Twilight Princess, where not only do we have darkness and gritty realism, at least as much as Zelda has given us thus far, there's a lot of animals. There's a lot of animals in Zelda, and thanks to us being able to become one ourselves, literally, we get to interact with them a lot. This is the only game where we get to play fetch, which is the best thing. We get to pick up the dogs. We get to love the kitties. And our Bomber's Notebook entry today focuses on one cat in particular. Pretty much the only one that you have to talk to. Maisie and I were talking about this a little earlier before we went on. Claire, are you a cat person or a dog person?
Definitely a cat person.
Do you have a cat?
I had two, but they passed. So I'm a little lonely.
So what do you think of Telma's cat, Luis?
It's been a hot minute since I played Twilight Princess, but I do remember the section with the animals and the cats in particular. Wasn't Luis kind of bossy?
She takes after her owner. I agree. Yeah, Luis is fairly standoffish as far as the cats go, which I think we've all at least come across a cat with that kind of personality. But she's also the one that helps us to rescue Midna after she's been bleached. That's the only way I can describe Midna's state during the whole Midna's Lament section, is she's been bleached.
Yeah.
Though I have to say it's interesting in this, because now that I'm thinking about it, the only reason we are able to talk to animals is because we are a wolf at the time. So we can talk to the chickens, we can talk to the frogs, talk to the dogs, the cats. Luis is not only talked to by us, but I think Midna talks to her too.
Hmm, I think she does.
There's a point where she's like, please, I need to go to Zelda, and it's hard to tell for certain. Like, obviously the cat is there. She is paying attention to us. It would be crazy that Midna would not know at this point that we can talk to animals. So even if she can't, it's interesting.
Maybe it's because she's from the Twilight Realm. Like they have those powers. They can talk to animals.
Maybe. I don't know. The description seems to be that it's because he's a dog, not necessarily a shadow dog, but she does have magic.
Yeah, she's not fully human. You know, if she was just a sort of ordinary Hyrule townsperson, she certainly wouldn't have that ability, but there is this magical otherness about Midna.
The only other time where we talk with Luis is the lead up to the final dungeon, where we are trying to restore Ilya's memories. And it turns out that the statue that Ilya had with her was initially given to the doctor as payment for treating her. But then Luis stole it. She doesn't give any explanation why she took it.
Yeah, I thought it was a bit odd, because initially you think, oh, has she done it to help? But she denies stealing it in the first place, because multiple sources I've sort of looked at, one goes, oh, she had the intention of returning it. But I think, well, why would you deny stealing it if you know Link is trying to help? Yeah, I don't really know her intentions there. It's a bit odd, which is surprising because she's so helpful. obviously when Midna's in trouble. But then there's that funny little interaction at the end. I don't really know what to make of it. She's a bit cheeky. I think she's a bit of a cheeky cat.
That sounds like most cats that I have been aware of. They just kind of do their own thing. And if they deign to speak with you, you should be grateful.
Sounds about right.
Well, we are still very happy that Luis was able to provide such help in our lives, as well as every other cat that hangs around in Hyrule. We appreciate any interaction that we get to have with the adorable creatures in Hyrule.
It's the weird cat things in Skyward Sword, though, that terrify me. They're the cutest things in the day. In the nighttime, they just try and attack you. They're terrifying.
Oh, but they are so freaking cute, though. Oh, my gosh, I want one.
It's the big ears.
Yes. It is. It's the ears. It's the fact they can technically fly.
Fly. Yeah, oh. You only find that out after chucking them off the side of Skyloft, though. I was getting my girlfriend Skyward Sword. Yeah, and I went, chuck it off.
We cannot be the first person in all of Skyloft to actually do that. Some child has taken one of those things and thrown them off. This, Skyloft is not a safe place. This is why they need knights.
Those big ears are like a, you know, evolution thing they've had to develop because they've just been getting chucked off all the time. They have to learn to fly. They have to.
They're so cute and unassuming, and then you go to touch them, and that's all she wrote.
You know, like cats.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, thank you, Caitlin, for opening the book on Luis and Twilight Princess for us. And now we turn to our feature of the month. This is specifically why we have Maze here with us.
Yep, that's me.
This is your grand composition, as it were.
I wasn't aware of that when I was writing it, just to let you know.
You weren't expecting to be interviewed about things you were writing?
I wasn't, actually, genuinely.
Well, there you go. Good job. Surprise! Lists are fun. I am a fan of lists, of countdown lists. I hate making them. I struggle, especially when it's like ranking lists. But it's really satisfying when you get one done.
Yeah, I've not done a ranking one yet. I'm too scared. I think that the order would just jumble in my head too many times, to be honest.
Oh, I do the same thing. I have finally started keeping a ranking of just the Zelda games. And for the most part, I have the top and the bottom set, and everything else is in the middle. It's just a jumbled mess. It depends on what game I played most recently.
What's at the top and the bottom?
The top is Skyward Sword.
Nice.
I am a sucker for story, and that game makes me cry twice every time. And on the bottom, if we're going to leave out the CDI games, because those animations and voice acting are the stuff of nightmares, is technically Four Swords. And I say technically because it is through technological limitations that it is on the bottom. Because to play Four Swords, the way it was intended, you need a lot of people and a lot of systems and a lot of tech. And yeah, makes it really hard to play. That being said, I love the entire series in every single game. There's not a single Zelda game that I don't like. So what made you go to the idea of relatable as a subject matter?
Oh, I'm going to be completely honest. I was just chucking any idea. What was I playing? Oh, I was playing the remake of Link's Awakening on the Switch, and I was struggling to get into it, and I think the reason why was just because of the... It's a lovely little game, but it, for me, I prefer the games that have a little bit more character depth, because I find sometimes you can relate to the characters a bit more. So I thought, aha, I'll just, what the characters I relate to. So, you know, I've been struggling for ideas. Then I started playing Link's Awakening, and I just thought, it's just not hitting the same spot, because I prefer the games like Skyward Sword or Twilight Princess, even The Wind Waker, because they're so much more fully fleshed. So that's where the idea came from, I think, yeah.
I actually tend to give Link's Awakening credit for being the first game in the series to actually start to give character to the characters, especially the side characters.
No, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I tend to, if I were to say which version of Link's Awakening is the best, I would actually probably say the Game Boy Color version.
I don't own a Game Boy. That's the thing. I wish I did, because I'd love to play the games in their original version. I just haven't really managed to get my hands on the original console. But, yeah.
I don't know. There's something about that version that tells the story, I think, better than the Switch version does. But that's a completely separate topic. But when you look at the progression at this point in the series as it was going from the original Zelda, Adventure of Link, Link to the Past, aside from two characters, essentially, two or three characters, nearly everybody else is rather cookie cutter. But when you got to Link's Awakening, suddenly every single character is distinct. Barely any asset model is reused. And every single one had their own distinct personality, which was really fun to see. And then once you get into Ocarina of Time, that's when things really started to ramp up with the storytelling and in-depth characterization. I'm glad that you took a lot of our main characters from the series to call out, because these are the ones that we're going to be looking at the most. I was trying to think of things to add to the list, which I had not looked at the list in a minute. And the first thing I thought of was, is Link on there?
Oh, yeah. The Master of Napping.
That's
me.
That has become me more recently. I have completely killed my sleep cycle for reasons I won't get into detail right now. But I have needed naps more and more frequently as of late, and yes.
Yeah, I've grown to value my sleep a lot more. At university, I don't think I did as much, but now I've just chilled out a bit. All I want is, I just want to go to sleep. Like, what do you want? Like, I just want to go to bed. I can finally rest. Yeah.
Bed is comfy. Bed is warm. Bed is home.
Yeah. I'd like to see a game where, has this happened before? So obviously in a lot of games, Link wakes up and then everything happens, obviously, to mm-hmm. him. But then, is there a game where he actually just goes back to sleep?
Where he goes back to sleep? Oh, I like
nice.
That.
That'd be quite nice to see. It's like, you can rest now. You can rest now, mate. I know it's been a stressful few weeks. You can chill out now. Just goes back to sleep.
That's really good. There isn't.
Maybe Majora's Mask was that. I like to think it ended happily
that's
it's all in his
we
head.
Get, though. We don't see him go to sleep. We see him ride off into the woods. And so the true nature of Termina and the world is left up to the player's interpretation. I have always seen the waking up of Link as kind of a symbolism of waking up and being alerted to the threat at hand, the hero has awakened, and we are moving forth. But, oh man, I love that idea. We've woken up, and then we go through. This would be particularly good if it was like a hard-hitting, maybe a darker game. And there's a lot more emphasis on Link as a struggling hero. And then at the very end, he's finally allowed to rest.
I don't know if you guys ever seen Lost, but it has me thinking of that, how that first episode begins with the main character, Jack, opening his eyes And that happens again later on in the show, like later on in the other seasons. I'm not going to get into that, but there's like some symbolism behind that.
I am going to take Fi as my most relatable here on this list. I love Fi. Fi, I think, is overly maligned. Thankfully, she's gotten a little bit more positive reviews as of late. But Fi's story is fascinatingly subtle, which is so cool for me. And I am also exceptionally pedantic. So... I love being literal and exact. That is partially due to my own fear of being misunderstood, but I like that kind of literal exactness. Being able to make sure that everything is exactly what I meant it to be. Which one are you, Claire?
Right now I'm still You're like, at the top you're still of sleeping. List. I'm Link still.
Well, listen!
I'm still... Yeah, I mean, I guess I prefer Fi over Navi. Like, Fi means well. And I feel like, even though she's a little direct and blunt...
I feel like Fi's the friend. You know when you go to, like, pull a push door or something? Fi's the friend that goes, that was push. You're like, I know.
Oh gosh, no, there are some specific times where if you choose the, we'll call it the wrong option, she will be kind of, she'll kind of berate you. She'll be like, master, so
she's a little sassy.
The most immediate example I can think of is in, so when you are revisiting the water dragon and she's been attacked and she needs the no, it's after this, so you you're revisiting the water dragon because you need to borrow her basin of water so you can open the way to the fire temple, and your only option to carry this basin from the water dragon to the fire temple is through use of our little robot friend. Well, he's not our friend because he hates us. And you can, when Fi says, shall I call for the robot? You can respond with, not him again. And Fi's response is, master, unless you intend to carry that thing on your back, we're gonna need him.
I just like her use of probability, like the statistics. There is a 78% chance that this could be the right direction. Oh, okay.
there's a couple of instances where Fi, just the way that she says it, it's just... Master.
It's sassy. It's sassy. She's so literal, it's sassy.
It's so fun watching her develop over the course of the game. But you have to be really careful when you're looking at it, because otherwise, yes, you get into the eye rolls where it's just, oh my gosh, stop with the percentages. I know where I'm going. Stop talking about my batteries. Why are you? Oh, wait, you're leaving? Why are you leaving? And I care. Yes, her departure makes me cry.
Yeah, it's quite a sad bit, isn't it?
You call Beetle the overworked retailer.
Mm.
I find that interesting because he's I've never once... Well, no, that's not true. I was about to say I've never once seen him hate his job. Because I've worked retail. And I know what it's like to be overworked. But he's so happy all the time.
That's the face you put to the customer, though, isn't it?
True.
And he's in so many places at once, it's borderline impossible. And then in he's got his air shop in Skyward Sword, and you can see the sweat dripping off him. as he's cycling this thing through the air. And then he, if you don't buy anything, you fall. He makes you fall through the door.
That's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
excuse me, customer.
You could do that in real life.
Yeah, if customer, that doesn't say it works, I don't know what does.
I have been doing this. You're heavy. Dude, drop. When I play my games, especially when I'm playing them on Twitch, I will voice characters if they don't have a voice actor. Girahim is my absolute favorite character to voice. Oh my gosh. He is so fun. I love a 100% unapologetically evil villain who knows he's evil and is freaking loving every minute of it. It's a lost art. Like, seriously, every single villain that we've had in popular media for the last 15 years, it seems, has some tragic backstory or some kind of moral point or something to that effect, which is fine. But are you like trying to excuse all of the atrocities that they just went through? No, I'm evil and I freaking love it.
Yeah, Girahim owns it, I think. Mm. What I like though about his character is, if you're not, I suppose if you're new to the franchise and you're playing Skyward Sword, you, because of his sort of unapologetically evil nature, I suppose it's a bit of a red herring to the Demon King being resurrected. At least that's how it was for me when I played it. I wasn't aware of the Demon King Ganondorf at all. So Girahim being a pawn in this big game, to me at the time, was a shock. And I think that's why I liked his character, because you think he's the big bad. But when I played it, I thought, oh, no, he's not. But he's, yeah, for a character to be that evil, to be sort of second in command, was a little bit scary. I thought, that's why I like his character as well. He is just a pawn.
What was your first Zelda game?
That was Scarlet Sword. I think I was 11.
That was your first.
I think I was 11, I think, when I started playing it. So I didn't really know very much. So that caught me off guard, obviously. But I think my next one was Ocarina of Time. So then I sort of started to realise more about the actual, reincarnation part of it. So I technically played in chronological order, starting with Skyward Sword. So that set me up. But
that's amazing.
So I think going back to the Link's Awakening thing, I've played the more in-depth characters first. So when I've gone back to the earlier games, I've struggled to have that connection with them, because I can't. I like the storytelling.
Love the storytelling. It's my favorite. I'm going to jump. I want to jump to Tingle. Because when I turned 35 and I was playing, I think it was, I was playing Majora's Mask or something like that, Tingle was there, and I thought to myself, crap, I am Tingle's age now. I am now Tingle now. What does that say about me?
Are we old? I'm getting up to 30.
I'm 37, I'm not old. I will be using that Monty Python line for the entirety of this year, for another 6 months. Until I turn 38, I am using that line. I can be old then. I'm not old now. I actually have somebody on my Twitch, a person who follows me, who loves Tingle. I don't know how serious they are about loving Tingle, or if they just do it to get the groans. But he's so happy when it's Tingle time. And I'm playing Hyrule Warriors right now, so Tingle is a playable character on that. So Tingle time can happen on a regular basis.
I love Hyrule Warriors. That's the only Zelda game my sister will play, so we have to play it together.
Nice.
But Tingle scares me on that, though. as a character, I think, you know, good for you. You're in your lane. You enjoy what you do. You're happy in yourself. Great. But he just scares me with Hyrule Warriors. I don't know why. I feel like he shouldn't be fighting. He's just a bit too happy about it all.
Part of it is his design, the way he runs.
Yeah.
His face. It's just... Why? Why have you done this?
Yeah, his design in Wind Waker. Wind Waker is a lot more easy on the eye, I think.
It's more cartoony.
Yeah,
that's the thing. I'm glad that the Tingle in Twilight Princess did not take after his inspiration. He can just be a money grubbing con artist. I'm fine with that. As opposed to the rest of his games, where he is, in fact, a money-grubbing con artist. Do you have anyone that you would want to add to the list? For example, any minor characters, or maybe just ones that we haven't touched?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I was wondering if you'd ask that, to be honest, because I didn't want to put too many on there. And I suppose... I didn't want to dwarf it with Breath of the Wild characters, because Breath of the Wild is not my favourite game. I didn't want to come across as if I'd only played Breath of the Wild, because I've played loads of Zelda games. But I was thinking about Mipha, because I suppose something I didn't really touch on is unrequited feelings. And something's very much hinted at in Mipha's story, that she potentially has feelings for Link. So I was wondering about putting Mipha in. I decided against it in the end. I didn't want to put too many Breath of the Wild characters in it. But I suppose that is one. I'm sure a lot of people have dealt with unrequited feelings or love or affection. So yeah, I suppose Mipha, if that's the first character that springs to mind, really.
I've had a crush, yes.
Although it's not really... confirmed, is it, in Breath of the Wild? It's just very much subtext.
I mean, it kind of depends on how much of a shipper you are. It's fairly obvious that Mipha has feelings for Link. In fact, it's canon that she had feelings for Link. The Zora armor was made by Mipha and fits Link perfectly.
Yeah.
That's a whole story beat. The question is, did Link reciprocate those feelings? And... we don't know.
No. He should really communicate his feelings a bit more.
You want Link to communicate? What are you talking about? Next, you're going to want him voice acted or something.
Yeah, he's going to voice act and then fall to sleep at the end of the game.
Yay! He'll say one word. Good night. I guess that's two. I was actually thinking of Riju when it came to this list. She doesn't necessarily seem to suffer from imposter syndrome. Especially by the time we get to Tears of the Kingdom, she has become exceptionally capable. But she has a lot put on her in Breath of the Wild. And there's very little she feels like she can do, given her age, how suddenly she was thrown into the position. Trying to think of a couple of side characters. Go back to Link's Awakening. There's the crocodile, who is so happy that we have brought him dog food that he just eats the whole thing, can included.
Yeah.
Have you ever had the munchies so bad that you wanted to just eat the whole thing? Oh, that reminds me. I need to make dinner. Now I'm hungry.
I suppose in Link's Awakening as well, there is that character. It's Bow Wow, and he's this most prized like pet.
He's a good boy.
I suppose the owner does dote on him quite a lot. So I suppose that's quite a relatable character as well.
Yeah. He is a good boy. We love him.
I was just deep in thought, thinking through all the games, and I actually just thought about Kremia again. I know we were talking about her earlier, but I think she's pretty relatable in a sense, because she's just trying to like live her day-to-day life, taking care of her younger sister, and she's trying to keep it all together with like the weight of the world on her shoulders, and she's very, I don't know, she doesn't really show her feelings really. And I guess maybe that's relatable to a lot of people, like we're just going through the motions of life, trying to keep everything together to ourselves and just get by.
Yeah, we didn't go through the list of everything that Kremia kind of unloads on Link. The moon, obviously. How obviously it's getting bigger and bigger with every passing hour. There's the obvious problem that she's having with the Gorman brothers. The concerns about her sister, how she's talking about the ghosts, the aliens. And we want to talk about unrequited love. Kremia had feelings for Kafei, and he fell for Anju instead. That's personal trauma, as well as family trauma, business trauma, world ending apocalypse. That's a lot to be dealing with. And aside from the business being saved, Kremia doesn't get too much of a happy ending, if you really think about it. There's not a whole lot of resolution with her stresses. Most of it's focused on Romani. I think that's one of the things that I appreciate about Majora's Mask is, yes, the world is saved, but the world is not flawless. There are still things that happened that can't be undone or don't turn out perfectly. The Deku Butler doesn't get his son back. Kremia doesn't get to be with the one that she loved. I think the thing that I appreciate about Breath of the Wild story in particular is that kind of realization. You talked about both Yunobu and Princess Zelda. Zelda being the obvious example of someone struggling despite seemingly failing over and over and over again. And it really wasn't until after she had to more or less cast that all aside that things actually started to fall into place for her. Which is the hardest lesson for anyone to learn. And honestly, I think it's probably kind of easy to miss in Zelda's story, at least. Because it does kind of seem to come out of nowhere, her power.
I was just thinking about more characters, and I just got reminded about Paya.
Aww, we love
Paya.
And I
always thought, like, she's cute and she's kind of relatable.
Are you scared of men?
She just, you know, has a thing with Link, and she writes in her little diary every night.
Yeah, she's very sweet. I love how she's sort of developed in Tears of the Kingdom, though. I think she has a really nice sort of transition from being quite, again, I think a lot of the characters in Breath of the Wild struggle with following in the footsteps of those who came before them, who were great leaders. I think she struggles with that as well. A lot of the characters do, like Zelda and Yunobu and Riju. In Tears of the Kingdom, she's leading Hatano Village very well. I quite like seeing that from her character in Tears of the Kingdom.
I kind of wish we'd been able to see that progression in Paya. We didn't get too much of it in Breath of the Wild. Oh, that's what happens when you have a time gap. Things happen that we don't get to be privy to. You said Paya.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I realized I said Hatino Village. I meant Kakariko. Meant to say, yeah, got that wrong. Yeah.
We appreciate your correction.
You're forgiven.
That's all right.
For now.
That's all right. I literally sat there. I thought, oh my gosh, I can't be wrong. Fi would not be pleased with that.
Can we find Pura relatable? You said Paya and made me think of Pura. Are you looking up who Pura is? Check it.
Pura, I think I've got a lot more character. I mean, I played... Oh, gosh. It's the second Hyrule Warriors game. Age of Calamity. I think you've got quite a lot of characterization for her in that.
Yeah.
That's what I quite liked about that game. You got real insight to their characters.
Yes, Age of Calamity, that was the perfect setting for a Hyrule Warriors game. Because it's literally a war going on.
Yeah. Because I was trying to think of how I sort of perceived her in you know, the games. But then I thought I got a better grasp of the characters in Age of Calamity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I appreciate one's fanatical dedication to their craft. I think it's fun. I've become hyper-focused on something I was working on once or twice. Pura or Robbie?
Pura.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't want a guitar riff accompanying you every time you go anywhere?
Funnily enough, not really. It's not something I've really wanted in life. I don't know.
And want sick background music just announcing your presence?
I'll just play that in my head.
There you go.
You know, somewhere, there you pipe go. Myself up.
Everybody needs to have their own personal theme song. Well, with that, I think this is a good place for us to wrap things up for this episode of the Zelda Universe Podcast. Claire, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Maisie, thank you for joining us, especially for your contribution with your article here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We're going to do our best to keep this podcast running every month. So we hope to see you again in March for the next edition of our ZU Cast. Have yourselves a wonderful rest of your day.